Last week, I visited Center Stage to talk to artistic director Kwame Kwe Arma about their new play, One Night in Miami. It's about an incident that actually happened, the night that Cassius Clay beat Sonny Liston. And right after that, Jim Brown, Cassius Clay, Sam Cooke, and Malcolm X spent the night together in a hotel room in Miami. And I also talked to the playwright and to the actors in this performance. Here's that conversation. All right, so here we are. We're at Center Stage, and this new production of One Night in Miami, which is a powerful moment in history that was recreated out of the mind of Kem Powers, a playwright who joins us here at Center Stage, and my dear friend Kwame Kwe Arma, who's directing this and brought this here, so artistic director of Center Stage. And we're also joined by Sullivan Jones, who plays Cassius Clay, or as we know him now, Muhammad Ali, and Esau Pritchett playing Jim Brown. And when you walk in to meet these guys, you can see just why they were cast on one level. Their acting was a different thing, but physically, they fit it. Good to see you all.
Thank you, Ma.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for being here.
So let's take them back up for a second, because Kwame, you always have this wrestling job to do a season. I have to say this diplomatically, I won't get you in trouble.
Get me in trouble, Ma. That's all good.
A season that people, kind of popular things that people want to see, with things you think are dramatically important to put on, direct, produce, and for people to see, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, that's what the gig is being an AD, is making sure that you serve the multiple audiences that you have. There is not just one audience. Where One Night in Miami fits in that it kind of ticks several boxes. When those kind of plays come across your desk as an AD, it's a bit of a joy, because you know anybody who likes sports, anybody who knows Muhammad Ali, anybody who knows Jim Brown, knows the music of Sam Cooke, and that's multiple audiences, are going to have inroads into this play. But also, this play also makes a real rather wonderful and astute and subtle comment on the state of the union. And you know, I love those kind of plays that allow us to look not just at ourselves, not just at our local community, but to look at the nation and say, where do we find ourselves in this moment in time? And Kemp, who's a rather wonderfully intelligent writer, has managed to find ways to do that rather deftly, in my opinion.
As mentioned, Kemp Powers is the playwright, and he's here, also in here. Good to have you, Baldwin. Let's explain a bit about who you are, because you've been a writer for a long, long time.
Yes,
right? Before you became a playwright.
Yes, a journalist for almost 20 years, actually. And I definitely applied a lot of my skills as a reporter to the research that went into the creation of this play. But yes, a writer, a journalist, essayist, storyteller, and ultimately playwright, which brought me here.
And here you are. And we're set the scene with this play. This is a play that is about an actual moment in time in our history. This actually... Something like this actually occurred.
Yes. And I think it's kind of important to mention the specific passage that I read that inspired me to write
please.
The play, because the writer of that passage, Mike Marcusi, the famous sports writer, passed away
this
week.
Just passed away.
Yes.
Right. Great writer.
I was reading his wonderful book, Redemption Song, Muhammad
Great song.
Ali
Red
and the
book,
Spirit
I mean.
Of the 60s. Yeah. And there's a paragraph right in there that says, on the night that Cassius Clay defeated Sonny Liston, instead of going to the celebrations at the Fontainebleau, he went back to Malcolm X's room, where he spent the night with Malcolm, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown. And the next morning, he announced to the world that he was in the Nation of Islam.
So let me stop here for a moment, Kim. So, because I'm just thinking about, I know how those moments are when you're reading a piece, and all of a sudden this gigantic book, whatever you're reading, and this one piece just pow,
yes,
comes out and hits you, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, I just want to talk about where you were, what you felt that moment when you realized these four men were in the same place at the same time all night long.
Well, it's not only that. You have to understand that when I was reading this book, if you would have asked me who my four favorite people in the world were, I would have said those four guys. I would have said Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown.
Uh-huh.
So then to just accidentally come across the fact that they were friends and spent this momentous night together, the way I described it is that it's like accidentally stumbling across the Black Justice League. You know, my mind was completely blown. I was like, you mean my four favorite people were friends? It doesn't get any better than this. Yes, so it was a mind-blowing experience for me. And what I did then was, I became obsessive about finding out about how each of them met each other. So what you do is you just continue reading one biography after another, but you always go looking for those little connectors, those little dots. I'd be reading something like Peter Guralnick's wonderful book, Dream Boogie, on Sam Cooke.
Right.
And you get to the part where you first start finding out about how, before Cassius became champion, him and Sam had a really good friendship, and he would travel to different places that Sam was touring to hang out with him, and that Sam was almost this kind of big brother figure to Cassius. You start connecting the dots. How did Cassius start hanging out with Jim Brown? How did Sam meet Malcolm X? And eventually, over book after book after book, you kind of create this diagram of this incredible friendship with this so much potential. And then it's heartbreaking because within a year of this night, two of these men are dead, right. Both Malcolm and Sam Cooke.
Right.
So for all the great things that each of these men accomplished, there's also so much more that could have been done. And so that became the foundation of this entire play.
So this night, these four incredible human beings in the same room all night long, mm-hmm. Together. It's shocking that people don't know what actually happened in that room.
Yeah,
how did that occur, that nobody knows what happened in that room?
I see little snippets, but I think most authors don't make that big a deal of it. Some of the facts that came out were that they spent the night only eating vanilla ice cream, which is in the play. That's a little facet of it that's in the play. I've never met Jim Brown personally, but oddly enough, now that I live in Los Angeles, I've come across dozens of people who golf with him. And after the play initially came out in its original production, someone who saw it went to Jim and said that they asked him. They said, "What did you do? You remember that night?" And the guy told me that this is his words, not mine. He
right.
said that Jim responded, "Well, you know, that was 50 years ago. I don't remember many of the details." And then he stopped and said, "But I do remember that night I was talking about how I was thinking of going into movies." And just coincidentally, that's one of the things, I don't want to ruin the play, but it's just something that happens to come out. But I don't think you need to be a rocket scientist to just look at a calendar and see all that's happened and just think of some of the basic topics of discussion that could come up in a room like that.
As an artist and kind of the excitement of being able to create a world around something that actually happened like that and building a world that you think might have happened, I think this is kind of exciting. As soon as I heard about the play,
mm-hmm.
I read about it. I read about the play before it came here, just because when I read about plays and saw this thing was going up in L.A., and I said, well, that sounds really interesting. And then all of a sudden, Kwame goes, it's coming here, and we're bringing it to Baltimore, which is very cool.
And I really have to commend Kwame, because Kwame flew out to see the play in Los Angeles, and I think it was within a day of first reading the script, he wrote me one of the nicest, most collegial letters asking if I could fit him into a production in our little 99-seat black box theater at Rogue Machine. And so he was an incredible supporter of the play just from day one. And that meant a lot to me as the writer to make sure that the people who would be producing the play were as passionate about the subject matter as I was, and Kwame is one of those people.
I mean, the way this story actually went was that I started reading it. A board member actually said to me, "You need to see this play." And I went, "Okay." And then he hit me again and said, "You should read this play." And then another friend hit me up and said, "You should read this play. You really should need to." And then an actor who was in it hit me up and went, "You should read this play." And I was like, yep, I'm going to get to it. And eventually I got to it. It was 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning. And I was in my bed and I had a pile of scripts. I went, "So which one's it going to be today?" And I went, "Okay, I'm going to start with One Night in Miami." And I started reading it. And by about page 10, I went, "Really? No." And then I kind of went through and I got to the end and went, "Really? Oh my God." And then that's when I sent the email to Kemp. I said, "Do you think you could get me in? I'm going to see this play. Because if it's as good live as it is on the page, I need to boogie with this." And then my assistant bought me a ticket and I was in LA seeing the show the next morning.
That's how I felt when I read it last night.
Huh.
I was just like, I only knew about it and I read the play. Well, the words just bounced off the page and the whole thing was alive. And oh my God. I can't wait to opening night. I just can't wait for opening night.
Well, mate, I tell you what you can't wait for is to see these beautiful performers with his words.
And here we have two of them with us. Sullivan Jones, who plays Cassius Clay, and Esau Pritchard, who's playing Jim Brown, and bring them into the conversation here about these roles. And because you played this role before, right, in L.A.?
Yes, yeah.
Played Cassius Clay.
Yes, I sure did. Yep, and it was wonderful. And the way it happened was I submitted myself. I heard about the play from a friend, actually, and I submitted myself, and I got an audition, and I ended up getting the part. And then when I heard that they were doing it here, I tried to buttonhole Kwame and wrote him a letter and said, "I've heard really good stuff about you. I'd love to at least be considered for it." And I was lucky enough to be able to come here and work here, and it's been just tremendously exciting.
Because sometimes you find a role that you fall in love with. Is that part of what happened with this? Why you want to do this again?
Oh, yeah. Part of it is playing Ali. Who can say no to playing one of the most iconic, effusive, charismatic, soulful figures in the world? But also, I felt like we did it at a 99-seat little shoebox theater in L.A., and I felt like doing it here would be an opportunity to elevate not only my involvement in it, but also the play itself. And so it was really, that was what drew me to it, was like, how further can we go with this, right. You know?
And I have to say, Mark, that it's always hard when you've seen a show and you've seen a cast that were uniformly really good, and you've got to think about, if I ask that actor then to come into this production, what's that like? How difficult is that for the actor? And in particular the actor, because I can be rather arrogant and just go blank, and it does not exist, which I kind of did on day one. But Sullivan was just, I mean, so magnificent throughout the process, in that he never once walked into the room and you would feel, oh, I've done this before. You never once felt that he'd go, no, I know this trick. Kwame, I'm going to let you take the 3 weeks to get there to understand that this line actually works. You know, like there was, you know, I'll do it like this. And so he came in with the energy as if this were the first time and built the character again from the bottom up. And as a director looking at an actor in a process, I mean, it was tremendously impressive. And the only other thing I'd say about him is that he's not a bad ping pong player. I mean,
ping pong.
Yeah. So we're neck and neck. We play almost every day. Yeah. Three games a day. Yeah. It's contentious.
And who's on top?
At the moment he is. He beat me 5 in a row, man. And ooh. I pulled 2 back yesterday, but it ain't good enough.
I love it. Well, and Isak, good to meet you. So Jim Brown. All these figures were iconic.
Absolutely. I tell you what, man, it's interesting. I had been having a really good time lately, the past couple of years, playing some really, really significant roles. And I was feeling good about that, man. I was doing a bunch of Shakespeare, Titus, playing Aaron in Titus Andronicus, Mark Antony, in Julius Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra. But I got to tell you, man, I was feeling a little bit like I needed to do something closer to home. And somebody had asked me about it. It must have been about a few months ago. And they went, yeah, man, you've been doing these roles, man. How you feeling? I said, I feel great. But I got to tell you, I need to do something, maybe a little bit more contemporary, maybe closer to home. And I swear, you throw that energy out there into the universe, and guess what happens? Jim Brown lands in front of me. And to be honest with you, man, it was a little bit daunting in the beginning because, like Kemp said, you're talking about a superhero. I have grown up listening to my father talk about Jim Brown to the point where I was almost tired of hearing about Jim Brown. And then I got old enough to go and look at some archival footage. I'm a huge football fan. And actually getting involved in this process took me away from Jim Brown, the iconic football player, and more to Jim Brown, the activist. This guy was completely ahead of his time. So getting a really, really good education about him. But at the same time, having an opportunity to play one of these giants, man, just like Sully said here, it's just something that every actor dreams of in a career, period. So just really glad to be here, man, and feeling great about the fact that Kemp has written this wonderful play.
Amen.
Giving us, yes, man, amen. Giving us fantastic material to work with, and I just couldn't be happier, man.
And I have to say, you know, I felt tremendously blessed the moment that Esau walked into the room. I'm talking like when he walked into the audition room, there's one of these moments. I often say to young actors, you know when you walk into a room that actually the director, it's on your side, because actually they want you to be the one so they can get home early. Mm-hmm. They want you to be the one so they can leave feeling good that day. Mm-hmm. And Esau walked in, and from the moment he walked in, I mean, you will see when you come and see the play, he, along with all of these men, is a fine figure of a man. And, I mean, like, he walked in the room and you go, okay, here is man. So when he walked into the room, I and about everybody else, male, female, everybody was just like, okay. And then you do that thing where you go, please be able to act. Please be a good actor, because dog, I want to give it to you now before you've opened your mouth. And then he tore it up. And I went home that night and I threw down a prayer. I said, I went, if this brother says yes and Sonny says yes, I've got to play. I've got to play. I got this. And thank God He did. And again, you know, it's been a wonderful time here at Center Stage because in particular, and not though not exclusively, all of the women on staff have just been smiling from day one rehearsal as they see these beautiful figure of men walk around. I mean, I've never seen so many members of my staff visit the rehearsal room before. Just popping in, just going, oh, Kwame's just seeing if the aircon's working.
Kwame, just see. You realize nobody can see us blush, right? So it's not working, man.
It's true, though, mate. I mean, it's true. Even my wife said this morning, Mark, she said, have you thought about having a kind of like Ebony or Essence shoot with those men because they look good. I was like, lucky I'm securing myself, dog.
Maybe you should organize some women's nights and then they sell out to just women.
Listen, I tell you something. When they see those photographs, we're going to have those nights. It is a girly party night. They'll be like, Jim Ali who? But these actors are fine.
You're listening to my conversation with actors, a playwright, and Center Stage's Kwame Kwayama about their current play, One Night Miami. There's more of this conversation coming up when we return, so stay with us. And while we're on our way to break, we're hearing Minor Swing by Django Reinhardt. Today is the day he was born in 1910. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues that impact Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Join me, Mark Steiner, The Daily Record, and WEAA on January 30th for the 12th Annual Annapolis Summit. It's your chance to talk with the new governor and the attorney general and the Maryland legislative leadership about the issues that affect your lives and you care about. Tickets at thedailyrecord.com/annapolis-summit or 443-524-8101. Sponsored by Stevenson University, BG&E, Maryland State Education Association, the Center for a Livable Future, Alexander and Cleaver, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's I Feel the Earth Move by the incredible Carole King in one of the greatest albums ever produced, Tapestry. It came out in 1971, and on this day in 1977, Tapestry set a record after staying on the Billboard charts for 302 weeks. At that time, it was the longest-running album on the charts. This hour, we're listening to an interview I did at Center Stage last week with Center Stage Artistic Director Kwame Kwayama about their current play, One Night Miami. I was also joined by playwright Kemp Powers and two of the actors in this performance, Sullivan Jones, who plays Cassius Clay, and Esau Pritchett, who plays Jim Brown. One of the things I think about when I was thinking about this, reading the play, and the only person I've met here so far, obviously, is my friend Kwame, nobody else. But sometimes when you do a role, you know, you can do Shakespeare, as you were just talking about, you see, you know, and there's so much you can do with that in ways you can play all those characters, and it's a world unto itself, obviously, to do Shakespearean acting. But when you do a piece like this, which has a contemporary feel, even though it's about history from 40 years ago, and you're bringing to life people who we know, who you know, I'm just curious about how that feels, for an actor, before the playwright, for actors to kind of bring that to life. When you're playing somebody who exists, whose feet just may have left this earth 30 years ago or are still here, and yeah, and you know, and you're playing something that people look to. You two characters are alive.
Right.
Still,
right.
Yeah.
I tell you what, Kwame did something really informative as a director. I think it might have been day one. And we talked about trying to portray these guys and understanding that we're not doing impersonations. What we want to do is we want to find the truth of these particular characters. And obviously, there's going to be some iconic kind of movements, especially with a guy like Cassius Clay, that you certainly need to have. But you want to find the essence, you want to find the truth. And again, you know, because we're a bunch of guys that are in a hotel room, and we're not these public personas that, you know, people are in the public life. Right. We are able to take a little bit more liberty with just being human beings and acting truthfully, you know, in the environment and the situation that we're in. So again, there's no real impersonations of these guys that are going on. It's just about a bunch of friends, man, coming together and what possibly could have gone down in that hotel room. But as an actor, just, you know, a few things. I studied Jim a little bit, some of his speech cadences, you know, the tenor of his voice and things like that, some of his movements. But again, not trying to impersonate and not trying to be, I have to be, you know, essential, iconic Jim Brown.
Right.
Because I think that just doesn't work.
But he had a presence, too. I mean, absolutely. He just had, when you're in a room with Jim Brennan, he just has this overwhelming presence of power.
And confidence. Absolutely.
And confidence.
Yes.
Intellect.
Right.
Just,
if you don't think of Jim Brown as having this kind of intellect the way he does.
This is true. And like I said before, man, having had not much experience with him outside of football, not until I started to do some research and listen to what Kim talked about and read a couple of books, and I think one that you had recommended I read, it wasn't until then that I recognized how much about Jim Brown I didn't know. And I'm hoping that when people come and see this play, that they'll be able to, you know, to have the... you know, the same kind of understanding.
Jim's Baltimore. He's in the Baltimore Hall of Fame for lacrosse.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, he's renowned as probably the greatest lacrosse player that ever lived.
Yeah,
when there were no black folks playing for lacrosse,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I think it's very interesting for me because Jim was, of all of the characters, he, as a U.S. export, he was the least famous for me. Because, of course, the football didn't transfer. Right. Mm-hmm. So I knew him from the films. Of course, I remembered him from, you know, the famous scene with Raquel Welch. So actually, he was the character that I had to most research in order to be able to be of service in the rehearsal room. And it was so interesting because he was the character. It's that thing that you just said, Mark, about his energy, his persona when he walked in a room.
Right.
Because I would look at hours of interviews. And I found him really hard to penetrate, to kind of work out the psychological patterns, because he was just, there's just this confidence about him, just a kind of can-do, will-do. A brick wall is but a thing in front of me that I will run through. And that kind of confidence is really quite hard for an actor to kind of take and then personalize. And I tell you, Esau does it magnificently. He took on board the stature of the man, but then added a warmth and a humanity that was just a beautiful example of how an actor takes an icon and makes it something, right, and breathes life into it.
And it's interesting, too, because when looking at these men through a contemporary modern lens, no one can argue with the fact that of the four, the most famous today is Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. But if you look at this particular night, February 25th, 1964, the most famous people in that room are Jim Brown and Sam Cooke. Without question, Sam Cooke's one of the biggest rock stars in the world, and Jim Brown is the most famous athlete in the world. And Cassius is, remember the ages too. Cassius Clay's 22 this night, Jim Brown's 28. Sam Cooke is in his early 30s, I believe 31, and Malcolm X is 39.
Right.
In organizing the play in my mind, you have to kind of step away from the icons of today and reorganize that power structure based on like a friendship and fame on that particular night. And it's a very different power structure then. So I think a lot of people coming into the play may have a certain expectation of who calls what shots, but it's not that way. Ultimately, these men all have respect for each other, but what that means is because they do respect each other, they can challenge each other in ways that no one else would, and they'll hear things from each other and say things to each other that you'd be like, oh my God, no one would ever say that to Malcolm X. No one would ever say that to Cassius Clay. A lot of stuff gets said in this play that you would not expect to be said to these four men.
And Sullivan, your character, I was thinking just what Kemp was saying about these four men, and the connection for these four men is you. Mm-hmm. You are the one who, because you just fought this fight, and now you're now the world champion. These three men that you hung with in different ways, and the man who is your mentor and you look to, Malcolm X, is there, and you know that role he's going to play in your life and has played into this point. It's a pivotal role in all this.
Yeah. It's definitely like that. There's the quote, "Cometh the moment, cometh the man." Just how certain people. The moment is pregnant for something, and enter Barack Obama or enter Muhammad Ali. It was set up for somebody to come into the game and to take over. And so, yeah, he's definitely socially he's the hinge amongst all these three guys. And without him, the relationships probably are more tenuous, you know.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I just didn't think about this. I mean, Muhammad Ali was 22, but he was the kid of the group.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of listening, I think. Like when I'm personally in a room with everybody, like here at Center Stage, I listen because people know more than me and have more experience. So I'm just
are
like.
Is that what you're trying to say?
Like a real subtle way of going. I listen because I'm the baby. That's old folk. Go ahead.
Kwame and Camp are older, so. Yeah. But no, there's a lot to soak up, and so I think with these guys in the room, it's the same kind of thing. It's like they've been through the fire, and I'm just Ali is just entering. The fire. So what can I learn from these brothers, you know?
When people think of this, I do this piece every day called A Day in History that I produce every morning, and I really enjoy it. I get into it because I think about history as how it affects who we are now and how it defines part of who we are now. So what you all are acting in this thing is a piece of history. And I'm curious how you all view that, you know, how you view that that moment is affecting now.
I think when the audience come to see the play, by the time we get to the end of the play, the hope is that actually we will see this moment in history as being a comment on the here and now.
How do you see that?
I think that we find ourselves, these men are active and having discussions. That are, and Kemp said rather beautifully, that these men are talking. It's not hard to work out what these four men would be talking about at this moment in time in American history. Let's set it up. They're at the Hampton Motel and Hotel, and that is a segregated hotel. It's at the time in Miami, blacks could only stay high. I mean, every big black performer stayed there because they couldn't stay in any of the other hotels. So they're in segregated America amid civil rights. March on Washington's about to happen soon. That we're talking about Selma, all these things. So putting these men in that moment of history, these intelligent men, not these men who are just out there doing the vacuous stuff in their respective fields, but thinkers and doers and intellectuals. It's not hard. And so we find ourselves, that four men in a room, amid the civil rights era. And I think we could say that we are amid the second civil rights era. Right here and now, as we begin to look at what's been happening in the last 12 months. And I think this play speaks to that subtly. It speaks to the history and the present being bound. And because I happen to think history, the present, and the future are all happening right here and now. Correct. And so when one does work, one has to try and find a piece that has the string, the stretch in it to apply to all of those times. So that's, for me, it was why I was interested in the play. And as we got closer and closer to production and more things were being reported about, you know, justice and the sense of justice or not, as the case may be, particularly in the black community, this play felt more and more relevant as each and every case came to light.
So when you think about writing these four men, I know there are two extra people in the cast as well, the two bodyguards that are in that, but I mean, these four men, I really, getting in and under them and bringing them out, because one of the things about Malcolm, I feel it when I was reading the play, but I haven't seen it yet, I'm looking forward to seeing how this happens, is that Malcolm is always seen as this kind of figure that stands up and gives these incredible speeches to the world. But then when you hear people write about Malcolm X, it's the other part of Malcolm X, the father, the husband, the guy who could hang out, who knew how to hang out, coming from the streets, exactly, he could go in and out of that world.
And we do, yeah, I really explore a lot of this. I mean, one of the things I was most proud of when I wrote the play, and I explained to people, I wanted this to be a version of these, of in particular of Malcolm X, I don't think anyone's seen before. And it's the version I've read about, but I never see realized, because when you see him on film and stuff like that, people tend to kind of focus on that very public persona. And one thing that always jumped out at me about Malcolm X is that people said constantly he had an incredible sense of humor. He was a funny guy, which is something that I was like, really? Because you never see it captured in anything that you see. And Kwame made a wonderful observation about it, which is exactly how I wrote it. He called Malcolm a trickster. And that reference was more to the trickster in, like, African mythology, and that's fabulous. That's exactly what it is. Sometimes Malcolm will prod and do things to pull something out of you that he knows is in there. But he knows that if he just tells you, you're not going to do it. And so he uses his humor. Right. He really can undress you, but he's ultimately doing it to help you. And it was one of the characters that, I have to admit, writing it, it was the greatest challenge to write. Of course, writing it, I went through several drafts. I did readings. And the one thing that wasn't working in the early drafts was my Malcolm. And then I kind of like had to strip it all down and rewrite the whole character and getting into that humanity of it. And it, part of it is Malcolm's speeches. They're all so well known. They're all on YouTube. His cadences, all these things. And you have to just let go of all that. And I think everyone's been saying it. It's about getting to the truth and essence of each individual, using everything that I've learned and know about each of these men, and then deciding on my own how I think that person would react in this situation. Go. And that's how I kind of just...
So from the moment you read that passage in Marcucci's book...
Marcucci, yes.
Marcucci's book. How long did it take you to write the play? How long a journey was this?
Well, I didn't know I was going to write it as a play initially, but that's what started me on my journey of researching their friendship. Back when I first read the book, I thought, well, this is something I'd love to write a book about the friendship between these four guys. And as fate would have it, I started writing plays. So I think the first draft of the play I wrote really quickly in a couple of months, but it was very, very rough. And then I spent about a year revising it before the first production last year in Los Angeles. So a year and a half probably. But keep in mind that year and a half was based on research that I'd done years before that.
I would not have responded to the play positively, nor would I have wished to produce the play if the Malcolm character was the Malcolm that people automatically jumped to. I have said many times that the autobiography of Malcolm X changed my life completely, fundamentally, and for the better, as many of my generation. And it's interesting because to me, I don't see the other X. I don't see the hard X. I only ever see, when I look at his pictures and when I look at videos, I only ever see the twinkle in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
The joy that he gets out of possibly being a catalyst for your change. Out of dropping the seed in your mind and then seeing it go, and whether it explode, and whether you explode with anger or you explode with joy, either's fine for him, because his intellect was that agile, because he would know that he could talk to listen. And in our culture, we often think that you have to listen to listen, and he could talk to listen. Right now, your head nod tells me what, without you can't process it. And he would do it, and he would see it, and he would know that just a little would go, I know where to go next. And you would see the fun. Right. And every time, one of the first things I saw of him ever was a debate that he had at Oxford University. And he sat there, and there was this twinkle in his eyes as he was looking at the privileged class in Britain. And he was challenging them just subtly and beautifully with a real smile on his face. And that was one of the joys when I saw this production and when I read it, was I was just like, oh, here's a chance for me to dance with some of my heroes. And he and Clay, in particular, of course, Ali, share that twinkle in their eyes.
And that what you just said, what I was thinking about, was that the relationship, your character, Cassius Clay, to Malcolm, was just that. It was Malcolm reading Cassius Clay in many ways and pulling him into this world, because your man was trying to find his place.
Absolutely.
When he understood, I mean, he was the least educated of all of them in terms of books, right? Mm-hmm. Of all these characters, he was the least educated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jim's got a degree by that.
Right,
yeah.
You know? And they're all kind of very literate men in many ways, except Cassius wasn't. But the relationship between you and Malcolm was the one that kind of twisted, right?
Very strong, yeah. Yeah, I mean, when Cassius came back from the Olympics when he was 18, he won the gold medal. And there's a story of him going to get a hot dog at the local, you know, cafeteria, whatever. And they wouldn't serve him. And he was wearing his gold Olympic medal. And they would not serve him a hot dog. And so I had the chance to talk with Ali's daughter when I was in L.A. And she told me that there were a few moments, a few instances in his adolescence that really primed him for the nation, to be in a situation where he's like, all right, I need something. I need an organization to attach myself to give me answers to the conflict that I'm seeing on a day-to-day basis. And I think Malcolm was one of those leaders and personalities that, like Kwame was saying, really, in the way of the trickster in African mythology, really sort of brought something out of clay that was dormant and that he hadn't really had a chance to express yet. And the history is, it gets even more deep too, because they part ways not long after this, this moment of the, of this night, because Ali sides with the nation and Malcolm, we know, goes his way. But I think at this moment in the hotel room, at least in the play that we're doing, it's a loving, deep relationship. It's like they're brothers, you know?
This is, in some ways, I can see how Cassius might be a very hard character to play, just because you have to. Because when you're playing somebody who is almost illiterate, but deeply intellectual and smart, that's a dichotomy to play. That's really, you know,
He's street smart, and I think people can be. You can have linguistically, he was. It's like if you see a good rapper who's a freestyler. He may not be well read, but if he gets into a cipher, he can all of a sudden know how to work language and how to work his diction and whatever it is. But yeah, Cassius barely finished high school, you know, and this is a man that we know to be like the most loquacious public figure ever. So go figure, you know.
Except that, you know, he comes from the classic school of organic intellectual.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, you know, which we often don't think about in the West. We think that you have to have graduated with your master's degrees and your doctorate before you can be deemed an intellectual.
Right.
But African-American history is littered with the organic intellectual. Actually, sometimes in battle with the institutional intellectual. We just have to look at Marcus Garvey and Webb Du Bois.
Yes.
That was a classic organic intellectual versus, and we can have arguments about who was, I mean, not now, but because we have rehearsal, but you know, about who was most effective and who would last, whose legacy would last longer. But he comes out of that, Ali comes out of that magnificent school of organic intellectual, and it is because he comes out of that, which is why I would argue that his legacy will last for centuries, because it was combining his intellectual capability and his sporting intelligence. Two intelligences that were just interwoven in a most magnificent fashion. So few
taught how to learn. It was experience and observation. Right. And I mean, what's more, you know, intellectual than that? Outside of our definition of, you know, the bookish intellectual. But certainly, man, you watch this guy, you listen to him speak, this guy's on another plane. With his intellect, I mean, it's amazing, and it makes it even more amazing that he wasn't schooled.
Right. But if you see some of like the footage from meetings and stuff, it kind of like talks about how, as Black folk, we have a long history of oral tradition, where you hear stories by you know, through orators, through people's voices, and when you get into the meetings of the Nation of Islam, there's a lot of information being transmitted through by storytelling.
Yes.
And so it was an informal education, but he was absolutely schooled. He was scholarly.
So why don't we just do a scene from the two guys? And you could probably just guys, why don't we look at this scene where you two are talking about, what's that bit there? You can tell me the page number, no doubt. Where you're saying, what's wrong, what's happening with the nation right now? What's happening with, does that make sense? You know, what's it?
You ready, brother?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, act. Huh?
1, 2, 3, act, right?
Now, you two got more money than me. You need to be flying me all over the place.
And that is right. I am getting paid.
Listen, Jim, man, Malcolm has had it rough these past few months, brother. I mean, he's been getting worn down, Jim. He really needs his friends right now.
What is this thing with him and the nation?
Like, I honestly don't know. Every time I try to ask him about it, he dodges the question, or he answers me in these little riddles, but he says it's all going to work out for the best.
What does that even mean?
And that's what I keep asking, Jim. I mean, it just sounds somber. But look, you got to remember, it's easy to get disillusioned when the barbs are being slung at you from the outside and the inside.
Yeah, the barbs are being slung at us,
too. No, but it's different for us, Jim. At the end of the day, we lose ourselves in what we do. We escape from that reality.
There's nothing more real than getting punched in the face, Cash.
Well, first of all, no one's ever been able to touch my face. I'm way too fast for that, boy. Look, and secondly, me being out there in that ring is an escape. Now, I don't hear the cheering or the taunts. It's just me and that other guy. And every time I strike a blow, I'm punching every commentator, whoever doubted me, in his big fat mouth, man. Now, I may be smiling, but shoot, you have no idea how much spite has been released by the time I step out of that ring. And Malcolm don't never get to step out that ring.
Don't understand spite. Youngblood, my spite is on display every Sunday when I step onto that field. I like breaking tackles. I like hitting people. And I'd be damned if I give any man the satisfaction of seeing me run away from him or run out of bounds. No, he'll see my eyes every time. And then he'll see the bottoms of my feet when I trample on them.
You are one scary Jim.
Only to my enemies, man, and to them I should be.
Well done. That was great. Thank you, Brandon. Do the sideline. And you did it.
Thank you.
Because Jim Brown was one scary.
He is, of course. He's scary.
I mean, he always, more than any other characters, he was a scary.
Yes, you didn't know what he was going to do. He could cut you. He could cut you.
Right. Because when Jim Brown came out, when America began to see Jim Brown's as this kind of political activist, you know, all of a sudden, Jim, he scared white people to death. Yeah. And when he had this presence, and you were afraid almost to take him on, mm-hmm. even intellectually. I mean, he was a very deep character. People don't realize how deep Jim Brown is.
Bard, you know, he was, you know, you listen to him in these interviews, and he's very... There's no beating around the bush with Jim. He'll tell you exactly how he feels, straight and plain.
Even
you
know, like, today, right?
Yeah, I mean, you hear him talking about footballers of today, and he's like, I mean, you kind of go, really? You don't want to be just a little more subtle? And like, go, no, they're punks. Yeah. They're punks.
And it's not that I don't understand where these guys are coming from. You hear these interviews with professional athletes, and you can tell that they're working the media. They want to make sure they don't say anything that's provocative, anything that's going to, you know, end up all over the Twitterverse and whatever. They're just being, they never really tell you how they feel. Because if they do, they open themselves up to this ridiculous amount of scrutiny. So you can understand why they would behave that way. But look at a guy like Jim Brown at that time. The things that he was saying. I mean, the same as Cassius. It's unbelievable.
Well, the FBI was following him around, too. I love the fact that Jim Brown went and requested through the Freedom of Information Act to get his FBI file. Because he found out they were following him around just like they were following Malcolm around.
I think that I read in the book that they were actually trying to get into his business, man, and act as saboteurs for what he was trying to do. I mean, this is in their files. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is what they were actually doing.
Like they did with Harry Belafonte.
Yeah.
Where they totally sabotaged his money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mark, I can't thank you enough. You are, as always, a most magnificent supporter of the arts here in Baltimore, one of us here at Center Stage. Thank you for letting your listeners have access to these beautiful men that have come to bring their art to Baltimore.
Well,
Ken, Esau, Sullivan, and I can't rate them and the other cast highly enough. And if you want to come just for eye candy, come too. It's going to work.
If you're interested in seeing One Night in Miami, and let me say, you should see this amazing play. Do not miss it while it's here in town. You can find more information at centerstage.org. The show runs through February the 8th. And on our way to break, we're hearing Trouble in Mind by Nina Simone, which peaked in the charts on this day in 1961.